Morning. So today I'm going to talk about four yogas that are in our tradition that actually go back to the beginning before Buddhism and are right there in Zen, although we don't talk about them that way. So when I was a young man, very many years ago, I decided that I wanted the focus of my life to be discovering and living from a peace, from a stillness that was beyond thinking. I read about yoga. Yoga meaning to yoke. In Sanskrit, it means to yoke. And in yoga, we yoke ourselves. We join ourselves to something bigger than our small mind, bigger than our worrying thinking mind. We yoke ourselves. That's the etymology of yoga, yoking. And in the Bhagavad Gita, the Vedas, the Upanishads, they talk about yoking. And of course, in Mahayana Zen Buddhism, we also talk, we don't use the term yoga, but we talk about joining with a stillness inside, which is interdependent with all beings. When we feel the stillness, we feel connected to everyone, to everything. So in a sense, we yoke to that and aren't just caught by all this stuff inside. We experience our joinedness to everything already, not later on, but already we're joined, we're yoked. And so in both cases, in both the Hindu case, the early Hindu case, early Hinduism and Buddhist case, and Zen, timeless, spaciousness, deep, and secure. This is a different security from the security of ego. Ego's security is pretty tenuous. but this is a real security. What Katagiri Roshi used to call spiritual security. But I don't know what that term means, but it's a security that knowing that we're connected to everyone and everything, regardless of what happens. We are part of one family, regardless of how much we fight with each other. And we can be there for the members of our family, plant, animal, and human members of our family. So that mostly what I've done with my life. That's mostly what I've done. I mean, I've done some other things, too. I think my kids would be annoyed if I said that was mostly what I've done with my life. But one important thing I've done with my life. And at that time, early in my life, as a young man, I also read the Christian mystics. And I saw, oh, the same deal there. I read Meister Eckhart. A human being has so many skins inside, covering the depths of the heart. We know so many things, but we don't know ourselves. Why, 30 or 40 skins or hides, as thick and hard as an ox or bear's, cover the soul. Then he says, do yoga. He says, go into your own ground and learn how to know yourself there. Learn how to know your deepest self so that you feel yoked to everything. You feel connected to everything. You feel supported by everything and everyone. So there are traditionally four main yogas, and they're all present in Zen. Meditation yoga, or Raja yoga. Devotional yoga, or Bhakti yoga. Deep questioning yoga, or Jnana yoga, J-N-A-N-A. And service yoga, or Karma yoga. And I'm going to talk about each of those for a little while. Raja Yoga. That's our sitting. That's our zazen. Called the kingly yoga. Well, in Raja Yoga, it's assumed that you're going to do hatha to prepare. All the yoga centers, most of the yoga centers in this country, do an hour of hatha and 2 minutes of meditation. Well, that's not the Hindu way. The hatha is the preparatory for the Raja. Raja's the main thing. So here we seem to have skipped the hatha and just did the Raja. But now most of us are doing the hatha too. A lot of us have some kind of yoga practice because we realize if we don't get in sync with our body, our body is going to misbehave. My body has just really been misbehaving. Even though I've been doing my yoga, it still decided to misbehave on me. Bad. Bad. So, our Atman, use Hindu terms, our Buddha nature, to use Buddhist terms, and of course the Buddhists and Hindus argue about this. The Buddha nature is not the Atman. It's Anatman. And they all argue, but I'm not going to get it. I'm not going to go there. I ain't going there this morning. It's stillness. They all say it's a stillness inside. It's spacious. It's available to everything and everyone. And it's beyond thinking. It doesn't diss thinking. It's just beyond it. So anyway, the Raja Yoga, the kingly yoga, Buddha said, do not look to me, look to the Dharma, become a light unto yourself. Well, he's talking about exactly the same thing. And of course, that's mostly what we do here. Mostly we sit. Mostly we do that kind of yoga. Mostly we do. And we teach both focused awareness in our sitting and open, spacious awareness. And they complement each other. We have to focus sometimes, really, on our breathing. Maybe in repeating something with our breathing. Maybe even listening to an app, although I have resisted that. But now both of my wife and my daughter listen to apps, so I'm not resisting it anymore. It seems to help them a lot. So focus and then opening. But if we just open without focus, usually we're just kind of, our mind is like three-winged circus. And our, as the Zen school, as the Raja school, the Raja Yoga school, Bodhidharma is our main archetypal figure. So what did Bodhidharma do? Was he a scholar? Did he practice devotion? Did he do karma yoga? He sat. He sat and sat and sat and sat. And he's semi-mythological. But he sat for like 9 years. Facing a wall, and he didn't seem to get happy sitting because he looks pretty grumpy. But his eyes are piercing. His eyes are piercing. So he's our archetype. He's our archetype. He's a little bit of a stern archetype, but actually, all these other teachers were so light and ebullient, kind of make up for his sternness, I think. And this Raja Yoga practice, this Zazen practice, is basically the spirit of repetition. That's the whole deal, the spirit of repetition. We do it every day. We do it every day. We do it every day. Sometimes it doesn't work. Sometimes we're just think the whole time. Sometimes we think we're wasting our time. We just do it. We do it. We do it. And then we immerse ourselves sometimes in retreats. Spirit of repetition is the whole thing in Raja Yoga, the whole thing. We fail sometimes, and we do some more. So my wife quit her practice as a psychologist when she was 60 and decided she would take up the flute. So she took up the flute. And for several years, she just practiced every day. She took up the flute because she could travel and still practice when we traveled. So we would travel to see my daughter in Europe, and she would have the flute with her, and she'd practice every day. And then a couple of times a year, she said, Tim, I'm going to flute camp. I said, flute camp? She said, sure. We got to practice. We got to really do this intensely sometime if we're going to get it in us. Okay. If you're going to get this in you, if you're going to really tap into this deep stillness and practice every day, and you got to sometimes immerse yourself. Sometimes immerse yourself. So we have contemporary practices here and traditional practices. And our contemporary practices are all Raja Yoga, meaning we don't do bowing, we don't do much chanting, we don't have much ritual. We're just doing the sitting, just the Zen. Zen means to meditate. We're just doing the meditation, just the Raja Yoga. And Sunday is a contemporary day. And I don't know if any of you noticed, but I don't bow when I come in. because I've been trying to role model that for a dozen years, but some people follow me, but some of you just like to bow. So I guess you can bow all you want. I don't have any problem with it. Just bow. But that's devotional practice, and it's really not Raja practice. Huh. But Zen is both. Zen is both. Because the focus is on being alive, becoming alive to ourselves through this practice. Then the second one is bhakti, devotional. So most religion is devotional. Most religion is mostly devotional. And even 12-step is a higher power. You surrender to a higher power. You surrender to Buddha. You surrender to God, to Muhammad, to Moses. You ask for support. You thank them for their presence, the bodhisattvas and Buddhas. That's what most religion is, devotional, prayer. And Ramakrishna in India, he said, if you want to really know Kali, the dark mother, the mother who is beyond thought, beyond form, you have to cry for her. So devotional, cry. And he cried for her in his sitting, chanted and cried and bowed and chanted and cried. That was a devotional tradition in India. Really, really quite beautiful. And even in Native American, I worked with Native American people, and we would do these retreats, and these retreats are called Hamblecha, vision cries. So you cry for the Great Spirit. You give yourself away, you open yourself up, and you cry for the Great Spirit so that you can know her, so that she can enter you. So here we do a lot of devotional stuff. In preparation for this talk, I counted the number of bows I do every morning. I do 15 bows every morning here at Zen Center. Some of them are full length. I do 9 full length to the floor and 6 which are just to the altars in the kitchen and downstairs. I've been doing that for years. So people say, Zen's not devotional. Well, I don't know. What am I doing? I'm giving myself away. I'm surrendering. I'm opening up. I'm thanking the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas and the ancestors for coming into my heart. And I'm also asking for their help. I'm saying, help me. Help me. It's devotional. So on Saturday is a devotional day. We have a lot of ritual here on Saturday. On Sunday, we have no ritual. Sunday's a Raja day, to use the Hindu vernacular. A Raja day, we just sit. And we do this little chant at the very end, right? So my teacher used to talk about his teacher having calluses on his forehead from bowing, because they didn't have these zabatons. They just bowed to the hardwood floor, and he had calluses. My teacher thought it was a big deal. I thought, well, that is weird. But, you know, it's the practice. It's the practice. And we bow to images of the Buddha, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. We bow to the teachers and the lineage. And then we do offerings in devotional spirituality. Offerings of flowers, offerings of, what are these little buds? What are they? We used to do incense. What are these buds called that we offer here? What are they called, Ted?
Lavender
buds. Lavender buds, yes. Lavender buds. And we chant. We chant. I can remember actually being as a child. My parents really were down on Catholicism, although my mother was raised Catholicism. She was a recovering Catholic. And my grandmother took me to church once, and I heard Gregorian chants. I had never heard anything like it. I was so deeply moved. My heart was completely open, even though I didn't know anything about anything spiritual. I thought, wow, something deep. So chanting, devotional. We open up beyond our small selves to something great and wonderful that we don't understand. We don't need to understand. Chanting mantras. We have a mantra here that I've recited every morning for years and years and years. Gate, gate, para, gate, para, some gate. Oh, years and years and years. And then we end every morning here. All Buddhas, 10 directions, 3 times, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita. Paramita, prajna paramita, the mother of Buddha. We're giving ourselves to the mother of Buddha. Buddha's mom. Buddha's mom. Just like Ramakrishna gave himself to the dark goddess Kali, who is formless. Devotional, devotional. And then pilgrimage. Oh, all these religions have pilgrimage as part of their devotional. You go to the place that, you know, that the sacred spots in Jesus' sacred spots. You go to the place, the Jews' sacred spots. You go to the Muslim sacred spots. And you go to the Buddha sacred spots. We do that metaphorically during our retreats. During our retreats, we have a meal chant. Our meal chant is, Buddha was born at Lumbini. Okay, he was born at Lumbini. We're on pilgrimage with Buddha. Enlightened at Bodhgaya, taught in Varanasi, entered Nirvana at Kushinagara. So we're on a metaphorical pilgrimage with him, because he's our ancestor and he's helping us open up to this great spaciousness that never leaves us, even when we're upset. And those places that you go to, some Buddhists go to India and they visit those places. There's not much Buddhism in India now anymore, except for the Tibetans. They've gone into India, and now they go to the sacred spaces, and they're taking some Caucasians with them. The problem with going to Varanasi, where Buddha taught, is it's so polluted that I read that spending one night in Varanasi is like smoking a pack of cigarettes for a month. So I think we should skip where Buddha taught and just do where the other parts, maybe. Kushinagara, where he died, and now is in Nepal. So Saturday and Tuesday we have our more devotional stuff, including the Raja too, but including both the Raja and the Bhakti. And then Sundays and evenings and contemporary retreats, we just focus on the Zazen. We're the Zen school of Buddhism. Zen means to meditate. So the third one, jnana, J-N-A-N-A. So, all of the koans come out of this one. Who am I? There's no self in Buddhism? Well, who am I? Who's this guy chattering? Who's this guy worrying? Who's this guy planning? Who is he? Who is he? Who is he? Who is he? Who is she? Who is she? Just a bunch of thoughts? Well, what are those thoughts? Whose are they? Do they belong to somebody? Who is that person that seems to own them? Who? Jnana Yoga. That's Jnana Yoga. Who am I? Who am I? Go to India and ask any of the teachers there what the most important thing. Asking, questioning deeply, who are you? Who are you? So you can go beyond your small idea of yourself. And the koans all come out of that in Zen. What is the sound of one hand clapping? What is this Buddha nature Tim Timmy's talking about? Where is it? What is it? How can I get it? Who is the I that wants to get it? What's the it that we get? On and on and on. And this practice, this jnana practice, can be done on and off the cushion. It's good practice. Good practice. It's for the spiritually adventurous. I did it at a time that I was obsessed with finding the answers to the deepest questions. If you're not obsessed, you probably shouldn't do jnana practice. Because you'll just trip out intellectually, you know, and you're thinking, bleh. Buddha sat down after years of asceticism and vowed not to get up until he knew who he was. What is this? If I'm not my physical body, I'm not just my thoughts. I'm not just my emotions. I'm not just my sensations. Who am I? Buddha nature? What's that? That's ridiculous. Who am I? What is this? Who am I? What is this? Non-intellectual. Over and over. Deep looking. Deep looking. And we can combine jnana practice with our normal sitting meditation, with our normal jnana, with our normal, excuse me, raja practice, our normal zazen. Get a little tranquil first in our sitting, then ask, who am I? Because if you start asking when you're all scattered, you just weave more and more stories. So calm down a little bit, then ask, what is this? Who am I? And then I found myself, as I was doing it, asking not only during meditation, but during other parts of my life. Who is thinking this thought? Who's mad at his wife? Who is this wife he's mad at? Right? So those are the three first ones, the three first classical yogas. The fourth classical yoga is karma yoga, service, service, bodhisattvas, bodhisattva service, wholehearted service in the world. The world needs us. Lots of suffering. The world needs us. Results are not important. I know you get bummed out. I get bummed out at least. I worked on homelessness for 25 years, and now it's worse than it was. What did I do? Did I help anyone? But we have to forget about results. We just have to give our service wholeheartedly. That's karma yoga. Karma yoga. And two main features of karma yoga in Zen are service, physical service to your immediate physical space. Important in Zen. Look at the garden. Look how well cared for it is. There have been some karma yogis out there this summer, just quietly working, just quietly giving themselves. How do you feel when you walk from the zendo to the car? Don't you feel a little better than when it was all weedy and it was all... Don't you feel a little calmer? Don't you feel a little more connected to those trees and flowers? So service to our immediate physical environment, key to Zen practice, going back hundreds of years. Morning work we have every morning here, you know. It lasts about 8 minutes. Every morning we do 8 minutes of work, just cleaning up the zendo, cleaning the mats, whatever. And then twice, during practice phase, we have twice work days and work afternoons. And you guys, some of you heard me tell this story many times. I started a sitting group when I was a young man in my hometown of Palo Alto that my teacher came down to every week. And I started in some graduate student's house at Stanford where I was going to school. And graduate students... stayed upstairs sleeping because we started, you know, at 5:45. I mean, they just went to bed at 4, so they stayed up sleeping. But the house was kind of messy downstairs. So afterwards, Suzuki would roll up as he would, you know, he wore these robes and then you can tie them in the back and you roll up the sleeves. He would roll them up and he would go in the kitchen and start washing the dishes and then he'd find the vacuum. But, you know, he wasn't doing this because he was annoyed. He was doing it because it's the way we serve. It's part of our practice. We serve by beautifying our environment. And I said to him, after he'd done this 2 or 3 times, I said, well, you know, we can't stay, Sensei. We have to go to classes. And he said, oh, okay, well, we'll start earlier then. We'll start at 5 instead of 5:45. I said, oh, my God. The world in front of us. We take care of it. We give ourselves to it, and it gives back when we give to us. Give us back. And then service to people who are in pain. That's what we do. We serve people who are in pain, those who are neglected, those who are really in need. You know, and people at Zen Center have done lots of things over the years. People have done juvenile detention center. They've done Joyce Food Shelf. They've done outreach to prisons. They've done Black Lives Matter, lots of things. It doesn't matter. Just some people are in pain. They need your support. The environment's in pain. They need your support. I was lucky for more than 20 years that I I found a service of helping people with mental illness, and that I was lucky because I had a lot of mental illness in my own family where people didn't get support. So I did that, and I was very happy to do that. I'm not saying that I always felt happy, but I was happy to be able to do that. There will always be immense suffering in the world, but we can offer our kindness as a karma yogis. All be karma yogis. Or if you don't want to use that term, who cares? Just think of it as your service, as part of your zazen, part of your zen practice. Knowing that you're not necessarily going to solve anything. And the room that you clean is probably going to be dirty in 5 more minutes. And once I said to Suzuki, well, these graduate students cleaned last night. So look, it's pretty clean. He said, forget about it. We're cleaning. Meaning, we don't evaluate. We just give ourselves. If we're evaluating, we're never really giving ourselves. Gandhi was a karma yogi. My service is my spiritual practice. My service is my spiritual practice. So, these are the 4 classic yogas that I've talked about. Meditation practice, Raja Yoga, the kingly practice, Who Am I practice, Jnana Yoga, J-N-A-N-A, devotional practice, Bhakti Yoga, service to others, Karma Yoga. And Zen incorporates all of those. And I want to talk a little bit at the end here about why each of them in isolation may not be the best. Why it's good to have more than one together, if not all 4. So, our Raja Yoga, where we just sit in a Soto Zen way, we just sit facing a wall. The Rinzai people are often critical of us. They say, oh, you guys are just sitting daydreaming all the time. You're just daydreaming and fantasizing and planning your day and regretting. What kind of Buddhism is that? Just sitting facing this stupid wall. Oh, they don't say stupid wall. But Hakuin said, referred to Soto people as we are as silent illumination heretics. Because we think just by sitting facing a wall, you know, something's going to happen. Even if we're in a stupor the whole time. So we're heretical. So the Rinzai people bring in Jnana Yoga, J-N-A-N-A, deep questioning is really important. Really important. So you can do, and I've done for many years, Raja and Jnana together. First, you rest in calmness. Gets a little bit of clarity. Then when the waters are relatively still, you ask. You ask. You ask. And you do a little more meditation, you get even calmer, then you ask some more, you go a level deeper. From this deeper resting, we ask even more until we, I won't say, if I tell you something, then you'll think that you have to go all the way through any idea, any idea, all ideas. But whatever I told you will be wrong. So Raja and Jnana, Zazen and questioning, can work together like the left and the right foot. But meditation and questioning by themselves can be kind of dry. Quite dry. What about emotion? What about the heart? Well, then sometimes it's good to bring in devotional stuff. It's good to bring in devotional stuff. Singing, chanting, bowing. I don't know if I talked already this time. Maybe I did about. Yeah, I did. I about listen to Gregorian chants from my grandmother. Wow. Now I don't think I'm certainly my chanting's not that good. I don't think any of us are that good. But we put the effort into it, and there's beauty just in the effort, to do it, to really do it wholeheartedly with a big voice. A big voice. but devotion has limitations too. Well, we know most religion is devotional, and most religion has big limitations. This whole idea about humility. Oh, you humble yourself, and then the ego's evaluating how humble am I. Bill's more humble because he bowed more times. And give me a break. That's what religion does. We got devotional religion becomes an ego thing. Not to criticize my Irish Catholic relatives, but geez, you guys. They're competitive in their devotionalism. Going to mass and all that stuff. I won't get into that. And partly we humble ourselves because we want to alleviate our guilt and feel good about ourselves. That's not bad. But real devotion needs to be more than that, not measuring. So devotion has its limitations. Another is that when devotional, we can maybe spiritually bypass our own needs because we're just giving ourselves away to the chant. We're just being pure by doing the vowing. And actually we have some needs. We have a heartache or a stomachache or we're pissed about something. And we're bypassing those to just not pay attention to them, to repress them, and just do the devotional stuff. That can happen in meditation too, but not so much, because there you are with a wall. There's nothing. So it's hard to bypass things when you don't have any vehicle for bypassing, except a wall. So that's good. That's why we call it the kingly yoga. That's what we call Zazen, the kingly yoga. That's why I'm calling it the kingly yoga today. They don't. Dogen says Zazen is the most important thing. And another, maybe the worst thing about devotional religion is that everybody thinks their way of doing devotion is best. Their God is the real God, their Buddha is the real God, their prostrations are the real one. So look at all the religious fighting that's going on in the world right now. It's all about who's got doing the best devotion, the best prayer, knows how to get to God and give themselves to God and get God's help the most, or Buddha's help, or the Bodhisattva's help, or emptiness's help, or whatever you want to say, or the Great Spirit's help. So devotion by itself has some limitations. What about karma yoga? Oh, of course, karma has limitations too. Oh, I'm helping these poor mentally ill people. I don't have depression. I just sit in zazen. Oh boy. Those poor things. I need to help those poor things. Oh, yucca. Yucca. We're condescending. So karma yoga like that is not the service that Dogen was talking about, or my teachers talked about, or Ramakrishna talked about, or Gandhi talked about. But we do get caught in that kind of, that we're better. Another thing we do that's limiting in karma yoga is we give up all our... I did the bhakti yoga. Another thing we do is become service workaholics. I used to be a county social worker. I lasted 2 years as a county social worker. I wonder why. Nobody I knew lasted more than 5 years as a county social worker. Why would that be? Because always people were dealing with people's pain and their pain and their pain, their pain and their suffering and their suffering. And we become workaholics. We neglect our families. We neglect ourselves. We neglect our own needs. So service is great, but wonderful, so necessary. The world is a mess, and we can help it. We need to have these complementary practices. And they're all complementary, and when we practice them together, they help us shed our skins. I talked about Meister Eckhart at the beginning. He talks about our thick skins, these thick skins that we of our thinking, of our emotion, of our stuckness in life, and how they those thick skins anesthetize us to all the chaos out there. Our chattering mind is one of our thickest skins, anesthetizes. But these practices help us shed these skins so we can be more, feel more connected to each other and to the world. And I know the problem is when you shed one skin, then you've got another one. Okay, there's another one. But it's a little more sensitive than the first one. It's a little more sensitive. And under that, there's another one. Oh, it's a little more sensitive. Don't worry. You become more open, more transparent, more alive. And you're no longer just an incessant chatter machine. How many of you would really fess up to being incessant chatter machines? You wouldn't do that in public. Oh, one person does it in public. Oh, it's a life human beings live. It's sad. It's a sad life for human beings. That's why we do this practice. And our chattering machine protects us. So I've been having back problems, as many of you know, and I was just in the ER twice. Once I got pulled off the toilet. Sorry, I don't give you an image of that, but here my supposedly Zen master gets pulled off the toilet on the second floor because his poor wife can't pull him off. And the EMTs come in. They're good. They're so kind. They're better than doctors and nurses, those EMTs. I've dealt with them quite a bit. Pull me off the toilet, take me to Abbott Northwestern. And then what do they do? They put me in an array of meds, right? Starting with oxycodone. Wow. I never thought I'd have the opportunity to oxycodone. Wow, some people don't do that. The doctor said, well, you need to do oxycodone. Oh, I need to do it. Yes. So 2 days of oxycodone. It wasn't as good as I expected, you guys. It did anesthetize me, but it wasn't a very good high. Just a kind of a dull high, but it got rid of the pain. So, life is painful. It's emotionally painful. It's physically painful. We have a lot of things that happen to us. We feel hurt by people. And so we anesthetize ourselves with our thinking, mostly with our thinking, or with our oxycodone. But I only took it for 2 days because I didn't want to get addicted. And I read all these horror stories. So it worked pretty well because they gave me oxycodone at one end. The next one was a muscle relaxant, also a prescription. So after, then 800 milligrams of ibuprofen, and then Tylenol. So I have four. And now I'm down all the way to the Tylenol. This morning I took two Tylenol. So I'm okay right now. I've got my belt on and I'm not experiencing pain. As long as I talk to you guys, I think if I stop talking, I will experience pain. So I think I'll start talking. I'm just kidding. I'm just experiencing a little pain right now. So I hate pain, but I hate even more not being alive. This is what this practice is about. Being fully alive in just this, whatever it is, being fully alive in it. Rather than da 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 da. And you can see all the da 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 da, but you open beyond that limitation. And that's what these practices help you do, these four yogas, which are Zen. So then we're a little more open, we're a little more vulnerable, we're a little more able to go up and down and meet life's ups and downs. So I'm going to close with a little phrase by Rumi, who was a master of the four yogas and probably had never heard of them, but that's even all the better. Every object and being in the universe is a jar overflowing with wisdom and beauty. A drop of the Tigris cannot be contained by any skin. Every object and being in the universe is a jar overflowing with wisdom and beauty. A drop of the Tigris cannot be contained by any skin. So I think that's what I want to say this morning. and I'll be glad to entertain questions or comments. If anybody has any extra oxycodone, we can pass it around. Questions, comments? Roger.
Where does the practice of Yogacara
come into this? Yeah, Yogacara is, it's a, yoga means meditation, even in, you know, in Buddhism. So it's a meditation practice. Yogacara has two main components. The one is meditation. So Yogacara is meditation, primarily a meditation practice. And I could go into the details, but I think it is, do you want me to talk more about that or not? It's about, Yogacara is meditation, and there it talks about how we develop accumulation of memories. And those, that accumulation of memories, which are known as vasanas, they give off perfumes, they coagulate into seeds, and those seeds get into our mind, get into our bodies, get into our emotion. Those seeds called bijas get into our emotion, and through the practice of yoga, the practice of zazen, we begin to see those seeds and release them before they sprout plants. So that's Yogacara 101, or maybe just Yogacara. It's not even 101, because there's much more to Yogacara. But Yogacara, yeah, it's saying meditation is the thing.
I read once about shamanism.
Shamanism? Yeah.
And, it's like we are digesting our memories.
Mm-hmm.
They talk about how when someone passes away, they talk about how this ego comes in, the folklore, comes and eats your memories away, and it takes you up. I don't know where it takes you, but it's like you are digesting every memory that you have. So when we sit, it feels like we are reliving or we are seeing that memory, and it's as if we are digesting it. So we are basically digesting our food, which is our memory, and we're letting it go.
That's wonderful. And Katagiri Roshi, the founder here, used to say, just digest your zazen. Just digest your meditation. He meant don't throw it away, don't talk about it. Just digest it. Just digest it. That's how you transform it. By not evaluating it, by not judging it, by not saying, oh, I shouldn't have that thought, but just digesting it. And that's how you purify it. Yeah, good. Thank you. Thank you.
I'm kind of new to chanting, and
okay.
I grew up Catholic and you know, praying the rosary, and, and then later having, you know, some things on other beings, you know, but I never understood it in Catholicism, and then I thought it was kind of an object in which to focus on or take focus away so you could meditate by doing this chant, but I don't really understand what chanting is for in the context of.
You don't understand how chanting fits into the context of this meditative practice? Well, do you find chanting calming?
If I know the chant.
Well, this is a spirit of repetition. We do it over and over again. I have done the same chant, the Heart Sutra, over and over again, almost every day for 50 years. It just does itself now. Tim's just gone because it does itself. And there's some beauty to that. So, is that an answer to your question or not? Or you have a different question? Well, there's no evaluation or thought. It's just, you know. A little bit of evaluation thought comes in sometimes, but it's, you know, the more we give ourselves to some, you know, and I don't know those of you who do music, but those of you who do music know, I mean, when Linda, my wife, was playing the flute, her best flute times was when she really let the sounds enter her so much that she had no comment, that she wasn't evaluating.
And you lose time.
Pardon?
You lose time.
Yeah, she lost time. Anybody else? Sure.
Where does the body fit in the four yogas?
Well, in Raja Yoga, Hatha Yoga is a really important prelude. That is, in the Kingly Yoga, in sitting yoga, you should be doing some Hatha Yoga. All the yoga that's taught here in the Twin Cities and around the country, 95% of it is Hatha Yoga. And in India, the Hatha Yoga would be like 3%, and 95% would be the sitting. But the body is really important. The body is really important as a preliminary to Raja Yoga, as a preliminary to Zazen, and also when we're doing the bare awareness, we need to include the body. If we leave it, so we focus and then we open up the bare awareness. Rather than chattering mind, pay attention to the body. The body has its own language. The body has its own songs. The body has its own problems. Part of our bare awareness is to just be with the body. Our meditation, Raja Yoga and Zazen, are a body practice. So it's not that just we sit and suffer in the body. It's sit and resonate with what's happening. Where is that anger? Oh, it's right up here. Oh, it's moving. Oh, it's going up to my throat. But we don't think about it necessarily. We just be with it. Oh, this is... Lena, is there something more to that question?
I guess I'm not sure why Hatha Yoga is not its own, like the physical thing is not its own fifth thing.
Well, I don't know. They did. That's how they developed it that way. I don't know. Yeah, do you have a response?
I think Kundalini is the one, wouldn't you say? Kundalini
yep.
is the one that really incorporates them together.
Yep. Yeah, that's right. That's right. I didn't even talk about that. Do you want to tell them a little bit about that?
People that are more intellectual, the sitting and things might be their access that's more typical with breathing and asanas.
Yeah. So
other more physical people will be focusing on their bodies.
No. So in the Indian Hindu tradition, we have the chakras and we have the Kundalini serpent. The Buddha serpent is the Naga who sheds her skins like Nagarjuna. In Hinduism, it's the Kundalini serpent who goes up the spine from the bottom to the top. And in Kundalini yoga, we experience that serpent energy, wherever it is in our body rising up. And finally, when it reaches the head and goes out of the head, then it's Raja Yoga. Then it's the Kingly Yoga because it's no longer caught by the body because we've let the serpent just do its thing, just be alive, and we've paid attention to it, and then it's ready to do Raja Yoga. It's ready to do Zazen. Would you agree to that?
Yes.
Yeah. So that's... Now, which is interesting because in Zen we emphasize the hara. This is where the Buddha nature is. But in Hinduism, they say, follow the serpent, and the serpent releases, opens up at the top. But these are all metaphors, remember. This is all metaphorical. Don't take any of this literally. That's why people have religious wars, because they think this stuff is more than metaphor. If we realize it's all metaphor, then we don't have to fight about anything, right? Just all ways, just all fingers pointing to the moon which is right here, or right here, or right here. Do you want to say anything more about Kundalini? Does anybody else want to say anything more about Kundalini? Oh, time's up. Time's up. The timekeeper is signaling. Okay.
Good?
Yeah. Thank you.